Hey guys, welcome to the Cinepile Podcast. This is episode 16. Like always, Cinepile is here to discuss films that matter. And today the film that we are discussing is It Comes at Night.
I just want to talk. And I want honest answers. Do you have any idea what's going on out there?
The door was already open when you got there.
Yeah.
Then who opened it?
I will kill you.
It Comes at Night. Well, we're going to kick it off with Neil.
What's up, guys?
Hey, Neil. How you doing today?
Good. Yeah, so we're talking about It Comes at Night. This is the follow-up film for Trey Edward Schultz, the director. His first film was called Creesha. We've talked about that on a previous episode. It was a super low-budget film, $14,000 budget film that won South by Southwest in 2016. So this was his long-anticipated follow-up film, It Comes at Night. Listening to interviews with him before it came out, even he would agree that this would be a very divisive film, that a lot of people won't like it. But he's hoping the people that do like it, that it sticks with them.
Is there anyone here that maybe didn't like it?
Hey, guys. Guess who? So it's going to come off this episode like I'm a negative Nancy and didn't like the film. I still liked the film. There are faults with it I don't want to ignore, and I think those faults are interesting. I think they're telling, and I don't think it's all Trey Edward Schultz, but as you'll hear, a lot of it has to do with expectation.
That's a big part of this episode.
A lot of people had great expectations for this film, especially with the way the marketing campaign was carried out.
And I think you saying that you are going to come off as a negative Nancy, I think likewise, maybe someone on the other side is going to come off as a fanboy for a movie when really it's like, yeah, I can see the faults in it. And I'm not saying this is the greatest film I've ever seen.
Yeah.
There's a flip side to that with an equal, we're somewhere in the middle, but going in different directions.
So before I come off too negative, let me preface this by saying, go see the film. I recommend seeing the film, even if maybe you think you're not going to like it, or if you don't end up liking it, because it's worth discussing. It certainly has a voice. We can all agree it kind of stumbles at times, but I would recommend it. Sometimes, I don't know if it's a personal fault, but I'll find something with a film and I'll latch onto it. It's like tunnel vision. And there are a couple things for me with this film. And really, so we're going to hold off on spoilers for a little bit.
And just like as a little side thing, I think that this is a good example of where the Rotten Tomatoes, even though that's like the holy grail nowadays, Rotten Tomatoes, right, that their reviews are accurate as far as how I think this movie is going to be split, where it's in the upper 80s for critics and low, I think it's 40s? The low 40s for audience. I wouldn't be surprised if this would even be like a high 70s for critics.
Yeah, because I almost kind of wonder sometimes if, because he is a new director and everything like that, I kind of wonder if some critics actually kind of pull their punches a little bit and are trying to, you know, not be so hard on the artist in a way, but kind of getting into it, because obviously you're a fan of him, Neil. Where do you think It Comes at Night, where do you think its strongest points are?
I think the strongest, and I think this has to do a lot with Creesha, and this is actually a very similar film to Creesha, which is funny, because Creesha is not a horror film. I would argue that this isn't really a horror film either, but it's obviously marketed as a horror film. But Creesha does take a lot of points of a horror film. Like, it has a lot of like a lot of cinematography, and the way like tension is built is kind of like a horror film, even though Creesha is just about a family reunion or a Thanksgiving gathering with family members. And it's the tension between members of the family. It all takes place in one house. The whole setting is in one house, just very similar to It Comes at Night. But the draw of the film is the family members and the people within it and the tension between those people. I would say that's the main thing of It Comes at Night that I think he does a very good job of, is he brings authentic tension that feels something that you yourself have felt maybe in your life, or that you, without them saying something on camera, you know what's going on kind of like in their mind. Or like, oh, I can see how this is unsettling for this character, or I feel scared, or I feel betrayed by somebody, or I don't know.
Yeah, and I haven't seen Creesha, but I'll say when it does come to It Comes at Night, a lot of the cinematography it was a very intimate setting, so they use where they could just follow, you know, a character's face or something like that going through a hallway. Instead, they let you see the whole environment. And so they use the space and size to actually make it feel smaller based off of the actual set instead of smaller based off the actual frame. And so, like, I think it just built a really great tension. Because the entire time, you know, I don't really have a lot of, you know, I mean, obviously, we analyze movies. We look at, you know, movies in a different kind of way probably than the average consumer. Sometimes you'll see a light and you're like, that's an unmotivated light. Where is that moonlight coming from? Or that's a weird transition of sound. But I really did many times just because of the suspense and the style of cinematography and like the how often they did not cut and how few and far between those cuts were. It really did build a lot of tension very well for me and dissolve the screen in so many times that I, you know, fell into it and I had my heart in my throat many, many times. And even though the like how we were talking about at the beginning, the, you know, the climax may have ended in kind of a, maybe not to everybody's expectations, but certainly I think the suspense that everyone could agree on was extremely well done and kept your eyes and ears always kind of looking, because it looks at that panic, that fear and paranoia that you have in just an empty house.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everyone can kind of relate to that.
I just had a thought, though, as I heard you talking about the house and the space.
Mm-hmm.
And although I agree that it was shot really well, thinking about it now, I would really have to watch it again for me to understand the layout of the house at all.
See, I actually really liked that. First, when you see the house, it's amorphous and it's like abnormally large. However, all you see are really the upstairs, downstairs, kitchen, living room. That's all you see. But this like entire house, it looks like a mansion from the outside almost. And it seems to have like this brambling kind of thing, how Travis is like, you know, crawling in the, like, you know, the upper attic and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
To listen in on people and to hear what his parents are saying and so on and so forth, and kind of like his little safe space, that it has this like just winding labyrinth kind of thing. And I love that because it really reminded me of when you're 12 years old and you wake up at your, you know, your friend's house and you're sleeping in the middle of the night and you wake up and you have to go to the bathroom and it is the scariest shit because you don't know what's going on. And I'll go camping and I'll forget I'm camping and I'll wake up and expect to be in my bedroom. And it has this, like, it constantly had that disoriented feel to it, purposeful or not. I like
personal
that.
Or purposeful rather, because dreams, how you're talking about waking up,
mm-hmm.
waking up from dreams plays a huge part in this film. A lot of the biggest moments happen when Travis wakes up from a nightmare and starts wandering around the house. So I think that's very likely the exact feeling they were going after, is that nightmarish, you don't know the space that you're in. Maybe what's around the next corner isn't what you think.
Okay, so as far as the set and everything like that, let's talk about the score. Because I know Neil and I definitely discussed the score a little bit and the subtlety of it, and that it was never too obvious, but it was always very present. Couple of marks there that definitely did pop up a little bit.
Well, no, when we were watching it, I didn't notice the score really, but Kyle, you made an interesting point when we were first talking about it, that there was that section towards the beginning or maybe the middle or something that really stuck out as kind of cliche horror film that took you out of the film.
I think this goes to the heart of my problem with the film, and I think it uses your expectations or my expectations of genre. Of that you're going in for a horror film, it uses those against you. Kind of a subversive way, but in a way where it's like, we're going to use the language of horror films just to elicit, in kind of like a bastardized way to me. It's the very first scary moment of the film. Travis has woken up from a nightmare by his father saying there's somebody in the house, or there's something in the house. I can't remember what exactly he says, but maybe that language goes to the other point of contention with the film, which is the title and the supposed monster out in the forest. It comes at night. What is outside? He's awoken from this nightmare, and it's like, oh, I'm not even going to try to imitate it, but it's almost like to me, like a cheap Nine Inch Nails. And the screen starts flashing at you, and it does that stutter as if those quick edits are going to make something scary. And the music just totally took me out of the moment. It did to me, and I think maybe now that I brought it up, it'll stand out to y'all as well. Just does not fit the tone of the rest of the film. To me, almost none of the nightmare moments fit the tone of the film. And I think, to be a little harsh, they're really cheap ways of using genre to elicit something shallow.
It's not even a counter. I will say they are using your expectations against you, but I do think it is in a way that is helpful for the film, because in a way, Travis is a viewer of the film. He, like, we're experiencing his fear, mm-hmm. like his paranoia of what's happening. So like his nightmares and the music and us thinking that there's something outside is kind of like getting us in his mindset.
Horror movie fear isn't what fear is. It's not a, at least like the genre horror film. I'm not talking about the pinnacles of the genre, mm-hmm. like The Exorcist or The Shining or any of those that kind of gave us a little bit of a different vision of fear in horror film. But that music with the distortion and all those things, it's like, that's not what, that's not the fear I've ever felt.
Well, that's, so that's why it's interesting fear. Because I didn't hear it at the time. So like, I guess to me, it must have fit because it didn't stick out to me.
Yeah, same with me.
But that's why now that I'll rewatch it at some point, I'm sure it'll stick out.
Yeah, I would like to rewatch it and see how that happens. But then just like how a lot of horror films find success is how they utilize silence. And I think very often, especially when they're going out, you know, into the wood, you know, I like how they still use like classic elements of fear. And it's like, well, there's the woods. It's like, why don't we go there? Woods are a scary place. And it's like the end. And it just having that kind of simplicity to it, but also where it's just like, oh, we're going to the woods. It's going to be silent. We're going to be listening for cracking twigs, rustling leaves. And they give you just enough to justify that fear.
Right.
And that's what I like. They don't ask too much, I think, from the audience to make us scared or something like that. They're constantly justifying you being a little bit on edge. But I'd like to talk a little bit more about it, and then we can get into spoilers, because I think we can't really talk much more in depth.
Well, we've already kind of spoiled a little bit.
The spoiler up to this point is that
it's not really a horror film.
Yeah, it's not a horror film. And so all of these pieces of horror film language, things like jump scares in the nightmares, when things pop out or when they show it in the trailers, like things are oozing out of people's mouths, to me, it just does not feel authentic to this film. It doesn't play into what's actually happening with the characters. I think it's ambiguous enough that you can take it and say, oh, well, it's Travis being afraid, and he's afraid of this sickness that's out there, and he's afraid maybe of what's inside other people. You can use all this kind of like ambiguous metaphorical language for it, but I just don't see those moments as authentic. It seems like it's reminding me that it's trying to be a genre film in a way when it's not.
Well, I think it's, I don't know if it's like a step beyond that, because to me, the film isn't trying to be a genre film. It's using a genre film as an excuse to get the story that is like what Krisha was. It's about two families meeting, or this family that happens to be in this horror movie story.
Why do you need to use the pretense of a horror film to do that?
They barely do. They don't tell you what's really happening outside. They don't tell you really anything. Like, it's just all, they use that pretense because most of it is still about fear. It's still about paranoia and how that can tear people apart and ruin your humanity or something. That's whatever his vision of it is. So the horror film is kind of the go-to, like, when writing a script, that's probably what it's naturally going to be. If you're going to talk about, like, genocide and stuff, which was, like, inspiration for this film or something.
What he was reading about. But see, all of that just seems kind of like, at the end of the day, I don't think it was necessary for the film. And if you were to take like a sharp razor and cut out all of the things that are extraneous, I think you'd lose the nightmares. I think him wandering around the house, or maybe some of the more ambiguous fears.
Kyle, you're bringing up really good points, talking about horror language and how the film is communicating with us to, you know, better express itself. So I think to kind of really delve into that, we're going to have to get into spoilers territory. So if anybody's listening right now, just know it comes at night. Neil, you approve of it?
Yes.
Kyle, you approve of it?
He recommends
tentatively
it.
Tentatively, yes.
And I certainly approve
it. He recommends watching it.
And if you guys have already seen it, then we're going to get into the good nitty gritty, chew the meat on those bones, and have a further discussion with that. But you've been warned.
I would recommend the film. I would also say you might be better off spending your time just reading The Road, because The Road is far more horrifying.
But you can say that probably about most horror films. I don't know. Like, but or any post-apocalyptic horror film.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of trash in the post-apocalyptic genre. This isn't trash by any
means. That's what I'm saying. Like, you could say that about... Because The Road is fantastic.
Well, it's phenomenal, but it's also doing what, in my mind, this film is trying to do, just much, much better.
Hmm. Well, I feel like we're The Road...
And I'm not talking about The Road film, which was okay.
Sure. Yeah. Well, yeah, because I think the Road book... It certainly, that was like one of the only books I've like ever read. So I'm kind of glad that you brought that up. That The Road, The Bible, and My Own Way of Law. Those are the books I've read. That with The Road, it really does a good job of examining the interpersonal relationships between the man and the son and actually exploring. But I think what The Road has that makes it work so well is in itself the own title, The Road. So you get to progressively come across problems in a very open environment. You find your fears. Nothing is illusory. There is nothing to fear but man itself. The end. And you follow those characters, and obviously it's more complex than that. But where it gets into, it comes at night, you are constantly questioning whether or not there is an actual creature that's skulking around in there. First they, you know, take it down like, oh, it is a person. Okay. Now there's a dog barking out in the forest. Okay. Now there's this other thing that's, you know, it's going to be cropping up and everything like that. So they constantly make you make assertions and then they make you question those assertions now. And I think that's what kind of makes it into a horror film, in that it makes you guess and then it makes you re-guess and then it surprises you a little bit now.
But it's all a sham.
It's all a red herring.
There's nothing out there.
Now, I think
The Road is clear and honest about the implications of the horror, this one is trying to make you think the horror is somewhere else, as if the horrors of humanity are any surprise to us in the modern era. There's nothing really horrifying besides the horror imagery in the nightmares.
That's scary.
Otherwise, everybody is acting reasonably. They're just scared.
Well, yeah, but that's the whole thing, is
there's no horror.
Fear is, what is it, false evidence appearing real. And like, so Neil and I went to the Alamo Draft House, and they actually did a really great job of priming the pumps to where it goes into World War II and just like sirens and everything like that for like 15 minutes or so, Neil.
Yeah, it was a long time.
And of people just like putting on gas masks and just showing like what fear and paranoia does to people, and that there's something about a gas mask that personifies that and is just the symbol of fear. And that's what our characters wear the entire time, and they're wearing their fear.
Well, the entire time they're outside.
Oh, yeah. Well, when they're outside at least, but they're wearing their fear on the outside. You know, it is a symbol of fear whenever they go outside. And so I don't know, I think they do a great job in making fear into a monster, because there's no such thing as a real monster, just the monsters that we make in our mind.
Yeah, it feels to me that this discussion is a thing completely about perspective, because
it is a
red herring, and we can agree completely that there's we don't see anything, there's nothing out there. I don't look at it as negative, though. And it's like a philosophical, like, there's a bridge that we can't cross. Of like, how do we discuss this? Because you see it as a negative and I don't. Or I don't see that as a negative.
Well, then just show its importance to the story.
I think it is what I'm saying. But why did I don't think you need to show it. And that's what I'm saying. There's a philosophical
point then would be that unless it's important to the story, maybe you don't need it in the film.
Well, you certainly need it.
But which part are you like?
Yeah, because
I'm talking about the whole premise that there's some other horror. Some unnamed horror, some monster in the woods.
It basically
that just plays no part.
Well, the part is we are like the characters in the film. We don't know what's out there. They don't.
They've lived in this world. Why wouldn't they know?
Well, they were even asking the other people, what's going on out there? Do you know, like,
well, that's
they don't
clearly
necessarily
because,
know.
Yeah, in my mind, it's because this
and
is
we
a post-apocalyptic
don't know
world.
What they know. That's the thing, too. We don't know that.
But
they
do know. They've lived in this world. They're not young.
But we don't
they
know that.
Were there, they were there for the outbreak. He prepared for this outbreak.
Sure.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't
we don't
he
know anything
what's
about
going on? Well, I mean, okay, you could just...
That's what I'm saying.
Like, you can go down this rabbit hole of saying...
But that's that with the point of the... That's like... That's... And like, we can go down this rabbit hole for a long time, and that's why it's like there's a bridge we can't get, like, cross,
like,
because...
We're asking to prove a negative in a way. Because you're saying they don't know what's going out there. Anything could be out there at any time.
What I'm saying is it doesn't matter.
But you need some evidence to show that there's a teapot circling Mars. Do you know what I mean? No, the old Richard, you could say that's
a straw man, because that's not what I'm saying.
You could say there could be a monster out there. Maybe the characters think there could be a monster.
You're changing what my argument is.
Yeah, let Neil expand on his idea.
All I'm saying is, that doesn't matter. We're talking like, they need, whatever they're showing in the film, it has to be important to whatever is happening in the film. But part of the purpose of this film is doubt or like fear. It doesn't matter what's out there. All it's about is about the people inside. It's not a horror film. It's used as an excuse for this story.
And then I'd like to make a point that the only person that probably thinks there's a monster out there is Travis. And it's only Travis a little bit that influences his dad when the dog does take off and then suddenly just gets swallowed up by the forest, that all of a sudden that the monster is a little bit more so out of Travis's head and is a little bit more into his dad's head. But the dad never responds in a way of a monster. Really, Travis is one of the only people that makes us respond that there's a monster out there. And that's fine, because that's us experiencing fear of irrationality through a child's mind. I mean, a 17-year-old child, but nonetheless through a paranoid teenager's mind. The parents are scared of raiders, are scared of disease, are scared of it fiends. Spreading. Yeah, fiends, ghouls, super mutants. They're scared for the actual rational reasons. That's why they're scared of the new family that came in. You know, they're the constant rational bit there. I mean, that can be really seen when he's like, hey, we need to quarantine each other. We need to do this. I think it's fair if we do this. Let's have a lot of transparency. So, I mean, it's fair to say that Kyle is seeing, I mean, I don't want to speak for you, Kyle, and so I'm not being a, you know, hope that you don't think that Kyle is seeing things from the parental kind of thing, towards like, well, it's ridiculous that there is no monster. Of course, it's ridiculous that there isn't a monster.
Well, I don't even see Travis the evidence. Monster. I don't see the evidence to say that Travis's fears are not, when he's looking out at the forest, of somebody with the plague coming up.
It could be that.
Yeah. So where's this evidence that Travis is fearing the monster?
I think the film creates the cloud and fog of war that is fear, and kind of lets you just kind of ascribe to anything you want.
It's a Rorschach test.
Yeah, you see his scary little drawings and stuff like that, that kind of points you in the way of a monster in some regard. You see the dead grandpa who's like vomiting out black blood, and the girl who climbs on top of him in his dream and like vomits black blood into his mouth. You know that there's zombies out there, maybe some kind of mythical thing.
You don't know any of that.
That's why I'm saying maybe. That's like, it's a bunch of maybes. There is no definitive yes, because it's about the irrationality of paranoia and fear and what it does to our rational selves.
But it's entirely rational in the film.
But it's being perceived by an irrational person.
How are they irrational?
I'm saying that Travis is irrational.
How is he irrational?
Based off of how he is dreaming and experiencing it.
It's not about being irrational. It's just fear. It's just, I don't know what, it doesn't necessarily have to be that them being irrational.
Well, I think just fear is,
because they're being completely rational, but that's part of the horror of the ending. They loot the last shot where they're sitting at the dinner table without Travis because he's dead. They have to sit there and have a dinner by themselves and be like, we just lost. We are worse than dying. This is worse than it would have been better if we just died.
That's
because
great.
We lost our humanity.
That's great.
That's
and
the horror.
I don't
of the
see
film.
How any of the nightmares or any of the monster bit help that.
I think it's just the poison.
If that's one of the strongest moments of the film, and it's also kind of thrown together in the edit, in my mind. Like, I totally felt something was off, and now my opinion of it is also totally biased by the fact that I know they had a completely different ending in store.
Yeah, they did.
And this was maybe saying piecemeal or salvaged isn't the right words. I have no idea what the creative process was behind the scene, but it feels like that moment to me is like that. It comes and it goes. It's one shot, and how long do they even hold on it for?
5 seconds.
Maybe 5 seconds. And it's like, if you're saying this is supposed to be like the culmination of the horror of the film, it's like they spend less time on that moment than they do on a nightmare that to me means nothing.
Yeah, no, the ending was not great.
No, I thought the ending was
I will
surprising.
Not argue that. Again, because I'm like I
but
said, I'm not a fanboy for the film.
Yeah.
But I'm on the other side still when we're talking about ambiguity of the film. And if it means anything.
I don't
anything.
Think the film is particularly ambiguous anymore.
It's incredibly ambiguous.
Now that I've thought about it, I don't see much ambiguity in what happens. Where's the ambiguity?
Well, yeah, I mean, the parents are definitely going to die. I mean, they touched Travis while he was diseased. So, I mean, they're looking at each other like...
Travis dies?
Like, this is the end.
The other family's all murdered.
It's Shakespeare.
The two parents are sitting there, most likely infected. It probably doesn't even matter if they are or not, because Travis is dead.
Sure.
The only ambiguity comes from this question of whether there's an it, or who unlocked the door.
Right, and well, the advertising what's for happening the outside, or what the disease is, or what happened beforehand.
Well, yeah. Even all those questions, they kind of don't even matter, because all you need to know is there's a disease,
and that's the
it's incredibly
horror,
infectious.
And that is exactly, I would encompass that with all of the horror of the film, because that's not the point of the film, that it doesn't matter what it is, what's outside, or
then
anything.
Why spend so much time on it? If none of that matters, why aren't we spending our time with scenes that are more valuable?
Because it is still about the fear of that, even though it doesn't matter if we know what it is.
But
because they don't know what it is.
Yeah, but then
you
this,
say they do know, but
fear,
we're an audience who doesn't know what they. That's you know that and that's the difference in opinion. Like that's the
that fear though. To me, the fear, if we're talking about. The fear between you and I and me never being able to know what's in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the best moments to me where somebody's lying or when somebody, you don't know if they're lying or not. There's
sure.
misinformation. You are limited in your circle of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
All of that is more suspenseful and scary than jump up scares and people vomiting blood.
Yeah.
Like that doesn't help us
yeah.
with this
well,
film.
Yeah.
No,
because your main gripe is like, is it additive or not? But rather than kind of taking a train down to negative town, I do want to talk about what the film did do right. And so one thing I want to talk about for sure is the mysterious man, I forgot the character's name, that the dad, Timothy, picks up. And when he's talking to him...
Wait, isn't the dad Paul?
Hey, you know what? His name's Tim now. You're misremembering that. So when he's talking to that guy... It's after, you know, they went on their supply run. They've built a lot of trust between one another. They're sharing booze between one another and the apocalypse. Like, finally, this is a point of, we've been through this shit. And then that's where all of it dips. And then it's one little lie that fucks it up. And he talks about his brother.
Possibly a lie.
And I thought right. that was something really, really great about the movie. In that he said, he's like, hey, you just said you were an only child, but you talked about how you lost your brother.
And those are hands down, in my opinion, as well,
oh,
the
yeah.
strongest moments.
And
of
that's
the
what
film.
I was saying in the beginning. Doubt. That's the best part of the film, is the moments, the tension between the people.
Yeah.
And that's
and here's
that's
another
the excuse of the film, is for those moments.
But all those scenes we're talking about don't involve Travis. And if he is the point of view for the film, I'm kind of a stickler at times for the point of view of the film. If he's our point of view, we have no reason to know those things. And yet we're in the scene with the father, the two fathers, breaking. It's now third person omniscient instead of what was at the until some of those points, a first person kind of film. And it's like, why are those the best scenes?
Well, I don't think it was a first person film. Well, I think we are in Travis's point of view, but more of like his worldview. Like his father, Paul, is all about like, hey, we can't trust people. We got to lock it up. If you let anyone in, it's going to be the end of us. Like he doesn't say any of these things, but that's like his personality. Where Travis is not that. He's kind of the sweet kid who's born in the wrong time. I think we're in his point of view as far as that. So what we see, we're supposed to kind of like, whether Trey Edward Schultz was successful in doing this, I think is probably whether or not people like this movie or not, if they felt that or not. Is are we supposed to feel for Paul's point of view, or are we supposed to feel for Travis's point of view throughout the film?
You're not limited to one or the other.
You're not, and that's what I'm like, and that's, I think that's kind of the good thing about the film. I think that's...
Well, but it's like, to go back to my point then,
like we should be able
we
to
have
see
a
that, the
third
scene
person
that you're saying.
Limited.
Yeah.
This, to use like literature examples, and we're jumping from father to son, and we're getting their two different perspective of fears. If I were to go back and look at this script... I would cut the nightmare scenes because I don't think they help that point of view of the film. Unless you're going to do something equatable for anybody else in a way. If we do have all these different perspectives and you're supposed to relate to different people, I just really don't see how those horror scares
See, I like it.
Fit it, in there.
It makes you irrational as a person. I don't know. It gets rid of the adult in me a little bit, as far as just like, oh, this is a disease, this is a survival film or something like that. It adds a little bit of salt and pepper to it to just kind of be like, eh, it could be some mysticism, could be a giant monster out in the wood, could be a Wendigo for all I know. I can completely understand, Kyle, is what you're saying towards, like, that's just fluff. It's just fluff that's added on, and it doesn't really do anything to propel the story forward, because ultimately, potentially, there could not be a monster. We don't know.
I would be disappointed even more in this film if there was a monster.
Oh, yeah. No. I don't think...
It's not a monster.
Yeah, there's not a monster. But I will say, going back to Neil, with your perspective shift and everything like that, one thing that the film did, I think, really well is when the dads go out to do the supply run, and they're doing that whole little survival thing. They kill a couple other dudes, and then it's, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks later or something like that, where they come back. And I thought that was a really good part about the film, that it did, that was about as big as it went, was going down the road, 5-10 minutes, I think they said.
Sure.
And that's as far as you get, and then you get sucked right back into their little world.
And they cut back. Like, yeah.
And I like that, yeah, because it keeps information away from us. It doesn't let us know what those guys experienced. And in a lot of ways, I hate to say it, kind of lets us see, like, you know, what Travis saw, which was pretty nil. You know, as far as, like, you know, getting back to the real meat and potatoes of it all, towards like, man, we don't need to see a supply run and all this other stuff. This isn't Walking Dead. We're going to bring them right back to the house, bring that tension back, and develop these characters further. But I don't want to be a dog with a dead horse.
I don't want to be a dog with a dead horse.
We always hated dogs.
Listen, guys, I don't want to be the dog with a frozen dead horse. But let's go ahead and move on. Let's talk about the marketing a little bit and why this attitude was really created.
I don't want to pigeonhole to say the attitude is created by marketing, because it is not. Because this, even without marketing, I think this would be a split film. But
yeah.
Well, the marketing title alone,
but it creates an expectation.
The title alone creates the expectation of something supernatural.
Right.
Something outside of them that is going to influence the story.
And not necessarily supernatural, but something else.
Yeah.
It could be a person. It could be something. Well, it doesn't have to be supernatural.
Well, the nature of the pronoun is pretty vague, but when we think of it, we're not
I think of unknown. Or I don't necessarily think of ghost or spirit or alien. You know, something is what when I hear it.
Well, and I think what it's saying is fear comes at night. The nightmares come at night, and that's when fear starts to overtake you. Because I know every single scene that took place at night, I was gripped with suspense and I was gripped with tension. Like when he was going down the hallway to find that the door was open, if a giant, like, you know, spindly finger thing, like, just went over, like, just grabbed his chest like a death claw or something like that, you know,
we got some solid Fallout references.
Fallout references today. That was something that was still a little probable in my mind, and I think that probability is because of the irrationality of fear, and that's what I liked, is the fact that they constantly, right when you got your balance back to you, you're like, okay, it's a disease and stuff like that. I was like, you know, it could be a monster. It's that it instills a little bit of doubt into your mind, and that's what I liked, was that continuance of wobbling you a little bit as far as your statement of opinion of whether this is a monster or not.
It kept me guessing the whole movie.
Yeah,
of
for
what
sure.
This was movie was about, of like, okay, and this is can be completely seen as a negative, and I probably would agree with that in a lot of instances. But it reminded me when I went and saw Midnight Special, when I had no idea what the genre of the film was, and I had no idea who was in it or anything about. I didn't even know the name of the movie. And when we went in, I'd forgotten what it was even called. And it was like halfway through the film, I'm still trying to figure out, what the hell is this film about? That had an ending to it. Like, the journey was like what was really fun for me.
Yeah.
And honestly, that's kind of maybe that's why I liked It Comes at Night, because throughout the film, I don't know if it was excited, but I was like always interested of like, oh, so is there something outside?
Yeah.
Like, oh,
where are we going?
Now we got this dynamic of like, who opened the damn door? Like, oh, now someone's going to fucking die. And like, these families going to fight each other. You know, it was, once you get to the ending, it was anticlimactic.
Yeah. Cause the mount,
and I can definitely see why people are going to be very upset, because you don't get anything out of it, like, mm-hmm. at the end. But the journey for me was what I enjoyed about the film. And I think that can be appreciated regardless of how you felt about the ending.
The journey was fun for me, minus those scenes. Because I think if I were to distill my gripes with the nightmare scenes down to their base level, it reminded me that I was watching a film.
Gotcha.
Whereas the other scenes felt, I know you're a big fan of his character dynamics, they felt real to me. It felt like it was really limited knowledge that I was peeking in on these people, and that I honestly did not know whether he was lying or not. It could have been a flip of the coin.
Mm-hmm.
And that was suspenseful. I'm not going to say it was terrifying, but I was not.
There was nothing in the film that was terrifying.
No, I was not taken out of it by anything in those moments. I guess they were, like, the other moments to me were just a little too on the nose.
See, the nightmare stuff, while I think it did take me out of the film, it still added to that mystery of me being like, okay, so where is it? Like, is this kid like psychic or something? Did he predict something? Because he had a nightmare and he said someone was here and then there was someone here, and like, where are we going with this? Like, is he part, I don't know, you know? Yeah. So is he manifesting some kind of power?
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of like Lost. It's a whole bunch of questions.
I'm not going to compare it to Lost because that's ridiculous, but...
It's not ridiculous. It's a whole lot of questions and intrigue. It's not exactly the same, but the idea is keep them going with intrigue and the possibility of something outside the normal human experience.
Well, when I say ridiculous, I don't mean your comparison is ridiculous, but I wouldn't compare it to that because Lost is ridiculous. I didn't think this was ridiculous, or...
The idea is that there's intrigue there.
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the character's journey. It's just that, okay, he's scared. He had a nightmare and he was scared in that moment. It doesn't have anything to do with his relationship to his father.
Neil brought up a good point that this entire situation, because I think the monster goes from being outside to inside. I think that's for sure.
There's no monster inside. Yeah, nobody
so,
in the film
so there
is
definitely is a monster that's outside. 100% for sure.
There's footprint.
Did you not see that? But I think it's kind of like
Yeti.
Yeah, you didn't see that. Kyle, wear some glasses when you go to the movie theater. Christ. But that the fear goes from being an outward bound situation that slowly comes inward and comes to reality. There's these people. Are they bad? They're not a threat. Now he's lied to me. Now they're in my house. Are they a threat?
Yeah, the fear was outside.
Yeah, the fear progressively got closer and closer and closer. Just like a fuse, and I think that was very, very well done, and ultimately it became down to children, and the children and protecting them, and being fearful of your children being injured by somebody else, and how Neil actually pointed out that if this movie didn't have kids, the families would just be hanging out.
It reminded me of, I think it was the first episode in Big Little Lies, there was like this pivotal moment that how you can pit human beings together in a very like natural way that you know is unsolvable. And it's like, this can happen. And it has to do with kids. Once you pit children and parents against each other, it's a natural, like, people going to die. Or something's going to happen. Like, it's an immovable object versus an unstoppable force.
Exactly,
like,
that. Can't... Yeah, exactly that. Because they couldn't let them go. Because if they let them go, they come back maybe. And you don't know that they could have already done this before. Like, you know, they could have had, you know, gotten burned. That Paul or Timothy.
however you feel.
They could have had a lonely stranger come by who, you know, that they gave him some food, let him back, but then he got hungry. And then he came back. Because even Paul or Timothy says, you don't know what people can do when they're hungry. And as if he has seen some shit kind of thing. You know, he is a guy who has seen reality. There's a reason he's a survivor. He's probably killed several people to get to this point with his family in this like house that they either own or have found. So I think
it's also just talking about that mentality of Paul.
Yeah.
Like Trayvon Schultz's stepfather is himself a prepper.
Yeah.
He is a a doomsday prepper who has that mentality. Like is like, hey, you can't trust any, like when push comes to shove, when society breaks down, you cannot trust anybody.
It's only family.
Totally. It's kind of like the dynamic where that comes from, you know? It's a soapbox issue for me.
Mm-hmm.
Is never, for one, never watch trailers for any film. Stay away if you can. It's really hard to do. It's more of like a guideline than a rule because it's really hard to do.
Especially if you go to the movies.
Especially if you go to the movies. But also like marketing in general for films. You cannot trust anything you see because the people that are typically making the marketing aren't the filmmakers who made the film.
Would you trust the sales guy?
You never trust a sales guy.
Trailer is a sales guy. At the same time, the title is a little bit alluding, and then the marketing took advantage of that. So it kind of took away from the artfulness of the like ambiguity of the title, and it gave it more of a definitive stature in that there is something that comes at night. It was something that comes at night, not it comes at night.
The marketing plays into it with a heavy hand in many ways. But even if you were to take the marketing out of it entirely, so it comes at night. In this film, what comes at night? His nightmares.
Yeah, fear.
And for me, weakest part of the film. And so for me, the title is referencing the weakest part of the film. In my opinion, plays in the least to any of the film's real moments. Real honest moments.
I'd say the nightmares were my least favorite part of the film.
And yeah. So to have the title not only imply that, and I think it honestly does imply as a red herring that there is, perhaps it's not supernatural, but it's unnatural to our world, that there's something outside of ourselves out there.
That it's the unknown.
That's how I would describe it. So there's something of a promise in the title of the unknown. It's literally telling you it's going to come at night. It comes at night.
And it purposely doesn't deliver it.
Yeah. And it purposely
doesn't deliver it. And I would not fault anyone for being pissed off about that. Or not even just pissed off, but just not liking that.
Well, it's just that I'm not necessarily, I sound really angry, but that's because what I'm saying. I don't mean pissed off. I just mean
disliking
it. Yeah, but it's just a disappointment. Untasteful.
Yeah. But I didn't feel that way seeing it, I guess. Just so everyone can gauge everyone's actual opinions of the film, we should do an Anderson scale.
Ooh, yeah, let's do that.
Let's do an Anderson scale of the film.
Okay, starting with Kyle.
At times, I would give it a 6. At its lowest, I would give it a 5. It's somewhere between those, because okay. I think the film's divisive.
Okay, I'll just do a number. 7. It's a 7.
I'll go with a solid 6.5, because I definitely would recommend it to other friends, and I'd certainly watch it again myself.
So there you go. There you go. It looks like
we round out to a solid approval. 8.
I don't know about your math skills there.
That's how you math. 5 or 8.
Guess we can call it a 5.5.
A 5.5 from Kyle. A strong 5.5. Some would say a 7. So definitely go see It Comes at Night. Let us know what you guys think about it. Let's go from here and talk about some of our recommendations that we have, because there's been a lot of good stuff out there. So let's kick off recommendations. I'll start first. So it's from a film, I want to say from 2010, and the film is called Waltz with Bashir. It's by an Israeli guy. His name's Ari Folman. Essentially, during the conflict in 1982, the war with Lebanon, he was mostly in Beirut, where all the conflict happened. And as an old man, he remembers a massacre that he witnessed, but no one else does. And so he's working with a psychologist, and his memories, his repressed memories unfold. You get to see more and more in the color, the style of animation. I would say that it's really interesting just because it is a foreign film. It's a conflict that really no films are really made about, but essentially about an Israeli soldier just witnessing absolute horrors of war and trying to recover a little bit of his humanity by going back to see where he lost it. Waltz with Bashir is something that you could watch with someone who's into art house, like someone like us, as well as someone who's into more so mainstream. But I would say Waltz with Bashir, I'd give it a solid 7.75 on the Anderson scale. It's a fantastic movie. Speaking of the Anderson scale, Neil, what do you have for us?
Well, on the Anderson scale for my film, mm-hmm. I'd probably give this one a 8.
Damn!
Probably an 8. And this is Senna. It's a documentary that is about... It's one of my favorite documentaries. And it also happens to be a sports documentary. But it's about a sport I know nothing about, which is Formula One racing. And you don't have to know anything about it to enjoy the film.
I gotta admit, that kind of put me off a little bit when I first saw it come out.
Yeah. No, it's a 2010 film, so it's fairly recent. It's about the Formula One driver, Senna, who was kind of like a...
Like a Lance Armstrong, like just unbeatable kind of guy?
I guess kind of like that. I was about to, I don't want to spoil the movie. Okay. I don't want to talk about too much about it because it's really good. And that's why the movie's so good, because it's a documentary and yet it feels like you're watching the events unfold as they happen, like as if you were alive in the time, because it's the same director that did Amy, the Amy Winehouse documentary that just won for best documentary last year. And it's very similar where there's no talking heads. Mm-hmm. There's no narration other than video and interviews that they have of people in the time that they're showing, and usually of Amy. So the Senna is about also a rivalry between him and, I believe his name is Prost.
Okay.
Who's another like famous Formula One driver, but it's very exhilarating and it's a documentary.
Yeah.
It's hard usually to get those two things together.
So eight.
You know, that's I'm a bold. Big documentary guy.
I know you're our documentary guy.
For sure. And this is one of my favorite ones. So I got it. You know, I'm giving it an eight.
Strong eight. That's impressive. Okay. Kyle, what do you have for us?
I got the chance to see I, Daniel Blake. It's a very human drama. It won the top prize at Cannes Film Festival last year. And it's directed by Ken Loach. Quick synopsis, a man up against the UK bureaucracy. And he, Daniel Blake, is kind of a relic in this UK system. He's behind the times in just about every way. He's a carpenter who had a heart attack and can't go back to work. And the struggles that he goes through, I'm ready to draw political conclusions from it. Someone else may draw completely different conclusions. It's not asking you to draw conclusions except to sympathize with this man. It's just human. The film has no frills. There's no distracting music, cinematography, any of that. All it is characters and a story. And so if that intrigues you, I mean, I can't recommend it enough. I'm in love with it right now. I'd probably give it close to an eight as well. I'd probably go for a seven on rewatching it. But yeah, I can't recommend it enough.
Well, to recap, so I recommended Waltz with Bashir. Neil, you recommended
Senna.
And then also, Kyle, you recommended
I, Daniel Blake.
And safe to say that if you're going to have a conversation about It Comes at Night, have a couple beers, because it's going to be a long discussion. Thanks for listening, guys. The music was provided by Stash Jenkins and also by Jesse James. Big shout out to you guys. Wanted to say thank you very much. Also, in closing, make sure if you're listening to this, if you could give us a review or subscribe, depending on how you're listening to this on SoundCloud or on YouTube, anything that you guys can do to get the word out in terms of subscribing or reviewing or just posting on social media is always appreciated. But like always, I've been Cooper Carr,
Neil Anderson,
and Kyle Montgomery.
Thank you guys for listening. Have a great one.